Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Most of the discussion of the COVID-19 coronavirus in the last week has focused on when stay-at-home limitations can be lifted, businesses can reopen, and people return to work. But almost 2 months into the pandemic in the U.S., there still are many questions about the virus and illness itself. To answer those questions on today's program is our guest, Dr. Amy DeWaters, Associate Division Chief of Hospital Medicine at Penn State Health's Milton S. Hershey Medical Center. Dr. DeWaters, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
If you have a question or a comment, this is a program where we encourage you to call in with your questions or send emails. 1-800-729-7532 is the number to call. You can send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. DeWaters, I'm curious, what question have you been asked most often over the past month plus since this started in the U.S.?
I think the question I've probably been asked the most is, when is the surge going to happen and when is it all going to be over? And of course, those are really tough questions to answer. It's very difficult to predict those, and we have some of the smartest people at Penn State working on trying to build those kind of predictive models. But that's probably the most commonly asked question.
The surge itself, when they ask that question, are they talking about Pennsylvania? Are they talking about locally or just what?
Usually they want to talk about the state of Pennsylvania. And that's a big point of discussion is, since we're in such close proximity to New York, are we going to follow a similar pattern to New York? And is our surge in cases going to be as significant as it has been in New York? So we're usually talking at the statewide level.
Mm-hmm. What about health-related or illness-related questions? What question have you heard most often related to the illness itself, the COVID-19 virus?
I think people are really curious about the contagious nature of the disease, and they want to know, how long are they going to be contagious and what they can do to control that aspect of the illness. So I get a lot of questions about, how long do I need to stay in quarantine? How long do I need to isolate at home? And how at risk are the people that are with me at home? So I think those questions tend to predominate, and that makes sense because we're all trying to protect the people around us.
So with those questions that you just listed, what do you tell them? What's your answer?
Yeah, unfortunately, because this is such a new virus, we have a lot of unknowns. So how long people stay contagious? Right now, when we recommend isolation, we're recommending home isolation for people who have COVID-19 until at least 72 hours after they have no fever without having to take anything like Tylenol. They also have to have improvement in any sort of respiratory symptoms. So any shortness of breath or cough that they may have needs to be significantly improving. And it has to be at least 7 days since their symptoms first started. So there's really three criteria before you're allowed to stop home isolation if you have COVID-19. And that's per the CDC guidelines.
Well, let me ask you about the symptoms, because as you said, we have heard so much over the past month and a half plus. Very early on, we heard about fever. We heard about the dry cough. But since this began here in the United States, took off here in the United States, there have been some other symptoms as well that have developed, that loss of sense of smell, some people loss of taste. So as of today, as of April 20th, when people ask you about the symptoms of COVID-19, what do you tell them?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. So it has evolved pretty rapidly since we first started learning about the virus. And you're right, it started with the fever and the dry cough. Now we're also looking at GI symptoms, and we're also looking at myalgias. So when someone comes in and says, are these symptoms consistent with COVID-19? What I'm listening for are fever, muscle aches and pains, what we call myalgias, GI distress, significant nausea or new onset diarrhea, shortness of breath, pretty profound shortness of breath. people very frequently saying can't make it up the stairs anymore, significant fatigue, and then of course the dry cough. So as you can tell, these symptoms are tough to delineate sometimes from other viral illnesses because a lot of those symptoms are pretty consistent with flu.
Well, yeah, I was sitting here thinking the same thing. That's exactly, as you're listing those symptoms, very early on when the initial symptoms were listed, it sounded, okay, you can tell the difference between the flu and COVID-19, but what you just listed sounds an awful like the typical flu.
Absolutely. I think one of the differentiating factors is influenza does tend to present with a headache. I have not had a lot of patients presenting with headache, so that tends to be one of the more differentiating factors, but you're absolutely right that the symptoms are very similar.
All right. So we have a few questions from listeners already. This is one that we've received over the last few weeks a few times. Is there any known cases, or is it even possible that mosquitoes could spread the COVID-19 virus?
So as far as I know, there's no data to support that this is mosquito transmitted, and that would be fairly unusual, I think, at this time of year, but no data right now to support that this is a mosquito-borne illness.
And part of it, of that is that this is something that is spread by close contact, droplets we've heard so much about, rather than, something that is related to fluids or blood, that kind of thing, right?
Correct. Absolutely right. So when we have patients in the hospital, we're placing those patients on droplet precautions, meaning we wear masks when we enter the room, and we actually ask the patients to wear masks as well as a form to control the infection that may be coming out when they are coughing.
Dr. DeWater, something you just brought up, it was another question that there seemed to be some confusion. Very early on, we were told that wearing a mask really did no good. Now we're hearing the complete opposite. First of all, are masks effective in not spreading the disease? If so, why?
Yeah. So it's difficult to know how effective masks are because you'd really have to do significant testing to know how effective they are. But masks in general are effective for droplet-borne illnesses. And that this becomes a very kind of nuanced point between what's droplet and what's airborne. And I think there gets a lot of confusion surrounding that. An airborne illness is something that can literally just disperse around the air around you. Now, they did a very interesting study early on where they studied three rooms of patients with COVID-19, and they took samples. And they took samples of the surfaces of the rooms that the COVID-19 patients were staying in. And in this study, the surfaces were positive for COVID-19, but what was not positive were the air filters. That suggests that this is not likely an airborne illness. It would be unusual for a coronavirus like COVID-19 to be airborne. So it's more likely that it is droplet. And in terms of droplet diseases, masks are usually effective in providing source control. Now, more effective is the person who has the infection to be wearing it. So I think that's where you're seeing public recommendations shift now, as they want people to be wearing masks themselves, because if they are infected, that is a better way of controlling contagion than necessarily everyone else wearing it. So that's why even when I walk into a patient's room with full PPE on, I ask the patient to put on a mask because that will be better source control than even me wearing a mask.
Dr. DeWaters, we're starting to get some more questions here. Just to let you know, we're going to call you on the phone because we don't have the best Zoom hookup here, but we'll call you on the phone and get you back in just a moment, okay?
Sure.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. For more information on coronavirus COVID-19, plus a deeper look at the changing tide of healthcare, check out WITF's Transforming Health online at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, WellSpan Health, and Capital Blue Cross. Coming up on tomorrow's program, Pennsylvania Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman will be here to answer your questions concerning COVID-19, the state's response to it. I'm sure there are a lot of other questions that we will have as well. That's coming up on tomorrow's program. Our guest during today's show is Dr. Amy DeWaters, Associate Division Chief of Hospital Medicine at Penn State Health's Milton S. Hershey Medical Center, answering your medical and health-related questions about COVID-19, the coronavirus. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You also can go to Twitter. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number is 1-800-729-7532. Hannah asked Dr. DeWaters, I've been reading a lot of articles about how the pandemic is affecting people that are experiencing anxiety and depression. I can't help but think the media and social media during this pandemic are contributing to these mental health issues. Let me just add there that, Hannah, you have to choose your media sources wisely. Same with social media, what you believe, what you don't. But Dr. DeWaters, what are your suggestions for those who are experiencing declining mental health during this time?
Absolutely. This is such an important area to discuss because not only is it an extremely stressful time, but you also may have lost some of your coping mechanisms, which may have included being able to go out and, you know, see friends, go out to a restaurant, and losing those coping mechanisms can be challenging. So I think what we would strongly encourage, first of all, is try to stay in contact with those people who bring you the most uplifting peace. Stay in contact. Don't shut down. Stay in contact with friends and family who can give you support. Secondly, can't emphasize enough that exercise is the great dopamine release and can really improve the mood. So even people who don't exercise regularly, you know, I don't exercise as much as I wish I did, but please, you know, participate in going outside for a walk is still okay around your home. The state of Pennsylvania is still allowing that. So I think participating in exercise is a great way to lift the mood in these times and really staying in touch with your support system.
Let's take a phone call from Jim in Lebanon. Jim, you're on the air. Hello, Jim? Jim, are you there? All right, well, we'll see if we can get Jim on the... Hello, Jim, can you hear me? Jim. All right, I guess Jim is not there. So let's take another question here. There were several questions from this one listener who asked, can you get COVID-19 a second time?
Oh, that's a very hotly debated question right now. So that's a fantastic one as well. So the South Korean version of the CDC recently released a report that suggested possible reactivation of the virus. And so it's very unclear right now whether or not COVID-19 may reactivate or if people may be getting reinfected. So two different things there. Reinfected meaning that you get exposed again and you get the infection a second time. Reactivation meaning the virus is living dormant and then suddenly becomes active again. Again, you know, this is just really tough because we don't have the data yet to prove either way, but certainly we are very interested in determining quickly whether or not people can be reinfected versus reactivated.
Also, same questioner wants to know, how long does the virus survive on surfaces?
Yeah, so 9 days is about the time that the virus can survive on hard surfaces. I think the thing to keep in mind here is that it's relatively easy to kill with disinfectant, and that's something that's very fortunate. So you want to make sure you're disinfecting commonly touched surfaces frequently, such as doorknobs and light switches and faucets. But 9 days is what we've been seeing the data report for how long the virus can survive on hard surfaces.
Another question from a listener. I know that many of the hospital procedures have been canceled, meaning elective surgeries, but many of those are necessary too. How have hospitals handled this?
Yes. So I think every hospital has been trying to handle it in their own way. Penn State has been phenomenal at sort of painstakingly going through and making sure that any surgeries that really do need to happen do happen. And they're having discussions right now about making sure that the patients who need to have surgeries, because even though we use the word elective, how do you really define elective? That gets trickier than it sounds. So Penn State has been really proactive in making sure that we look at that list of surgeries and that as soon as it's safe, they're able to kick back into action and get those scheduled.
You know, I've been curious, how do you keep the patients that have been infected by COVID-19 away from those who are at the hospital for another reason?
Yeah, so the patients who get admitted with COVID-19 to Penn State get admitted to a particular unit in our hospital. So we have sectioned off certain units in our hospital to be able to house patients with COVID-19, and those are rooms that have negative pressure available. And negative pressure is really beneficial because, just so all the listeners can understand, what it does is it prevents germs from leaving the room. So there's enough negative pressure in the room that when you open the door, it sucks air from the hall in instead of air from the room pushing out into the hall. So this is how we prevent the germs from getting out into the hall. So here at Penn State, we have very nice units with negative pressure available where we're able to admit patients with COVID-19 and take care of them there.
Let me try to get Jim back on the line. Jim from Lebanon. Jim, are you there? Okay, well, I have Jim's question then. Let me just go over it. He said that, how can I help a person know if she should be tested? I have a friend whose daughter has the virus, and they have been isolating. Now she is feeling achy. What should she know if she should be tested?
It's really tough to know when to test and when not to test, and there is a limitation on the number of tests that we have available, so that can be challenging as well. The best thing to do is call your primary care physician and run through your symptoms with them and see if the primary care physician is suspicious, and if so, they will know how to refer you for testing. If not having a primary care physician, you know, another option is to try to get in contact with Penn State and call our operator. And there are some telehealth options available as well.
Let's try to take another call from another Jim. Jim in Edwards. Jim, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay. So what's your question or comment, Jim?
They keep on telling you to wipe down your hard surfaces. And they tell you to do that all the time, but to me it doesn't make any sense. If you don't go anywhere, once you do that, you shouldn't have to do it again. When we go rare trips to a grocery store, when we come back, we wipe down the doorknobs, we wipe down the stuff we bought, we wipe down the newspapers, the mail. But once you've done that and you don't leave, there's no reason to do that again, is there?
Good question, Jim. Thank you very much for your call. What about that, Doctor?
Absolutely. So it really comes down to how confident are you that you're able to maintain that sort of contact isolation. So this is an example I would give you. So let's say you go out and you go grocery shopping and you pick up a gallon of milk and you bring in the gallon of milk in the cereal box. And let's say you put the gallon of milk into the fridge and you put the cereal box into your pantry and then you wipe everything down and you wash your hands. And then you go back into the fridge to pull out a gallon of milk. The question is, how confident are you that you've totally sanitized that gallon of milk? Because if you go back in and you touch it again, then your hands have been on this surface that could potentially transmit coronavirus to you again. So you know, it really becomes a question of how confident are you that you were able to sanitize everything fully that you're bringing into your home? Because if you're not 100% confident, then anytime you go and touch something that you've brought in from outside, it's possible that that may end up on a doorknob or a faucet again. So it's really about just trying to maintain good hand hygiene and good hygiene overall as much as possible. So that, I think that's where the recommendation for frequently sanitizing your home and frequently washing your hands comes from.
I'm hearing you say basically be overcautious.
Yeah, be overcautious. Now is a good time to be overcautious. And wash your hands and don't touch your face.
I've said this many times, but you did not realize how often I touch my face until we were told not to.
Yeah, I think none of us did.
Yeah, I'm trying to find ways when I have an itch on the nose to, you know, okay, how can I do this without touching my face?
Exactly.
Another question from a listener, is dizziness a symptom?
Dizziness. You know, dizziness is a very nonspecific symptom. It hasn't been closely related with COVID-19. What I will say is that you can get dizzy if you're dehydrated. So if you have other symptoms of illness and you're not able to drink and eat well, you may develop some dizziness. But dizziness in and of itself, just by itself, is not classically a symptom we've seen with COVID-19 so far.
A question from a listener says, how long does it take to get the results back of the test? Has the turnaround time improved at all through this whole ordeal?
So there's a number of different places you can go to get testing, and the turnaround time depends on where you're getting testing done. So, for instance, here in the hospital, we do have in-house testing available for those patients who are hospitalized, and that has been phenomenal. And I've been so impressed with our virology department to be able to get that done. So we can get results back for our hospitalized patients within 2 to 6 hours. Now, if you're talking about the Department of Health and labs like Quest Labs that are running a lot of the tests that are being done in the outpatient setting, those turnaround times are more 1 day to about 1 week is where those turnaround times have settled out.
What do you do during that week?
So it depends on what your symptoms look like when you come and present. But if the physician who sees you is suspicious for COVID-19 and they send the swab, then they're likely to tell you that it's best for you to isolate at home out of an abundance of precaution as they wait for that test result to come back.
You know, Dr. DeWaters, I may be getting into an area that you may not be able to answer, but I'll ask the question anyway, because this is a question we've received often. What if you cannot afford a test or you don't have health insurance? What are your options?
Yeah, that is such an important question. I wish I had an answer for that. I don't have a clear-cut answer for that. If you cannot afford a test or you don't have health insurance, it's very difficult to get. It is very difficult to get testing. And so I don't have a clear-cut answer for you on that one.
Mm. The Department of Health probably could answer that question as well. But, you know, supposedly everyone who has been recommended to have a test can get one, and there's some free tests out there. By the way, if you're just tuning in, our guest during today's program is Dr. Amy DeWaters, Associate Division Chief of Hospital Medicine at Penn State Health's Milton S. Hershey Medical Center, answering your health and medical related questions about COVID-19, the coronavirus. If you have a question or comment, we have open lines right now, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. And I think the problem we had with the phone a little bit earlier was more on the caller's end than it was on ours. So I think we're okay with calling in. 1-800-729-7532. Dr. DeWaters, we have a question from Greg who asks, what's the difference between airborne and droplets? Aren't droplets airborne?
So droplets are more coming out of the mouth as you cough, as you sneeze. Airborne would suggest that even as you sit breathing in the air, you may be transmitting virus just as you sit and breathe. So I know that's a nuanced difference, but droplet is more associated with the actual moisture you see coming from someone who sneezes or coughs.
Is a cold spread by droplets or airborne?
Yeah, so the common cold, like a rhinovirus, is more of like a droplet type of transmission, and coronaviruses in general are more droplet transmission.
Mm. And
coronaviruses in general can cause a presentation that's very similar to just the common cold.
Yeah, one of the things I've learned during this past 7 weeks or so is that the cold is actually a coronavirus. What about the flu? Is the flu airborne, or is that spread by surfaces?
It's not. The flu is not airborne, and there's very rare diseases that actually are. Influenza is not an airborne disease. The thing that's been a little bit unique about COVID-19 is that it does appear to be more infectious than influenza does. And that infectivity is a difficult thing to describe, why certain viruses are more infectious than others. But COVID-19 certainly has been proven itself to be more infectious than the flu.
And that's one of the big differences. I mean, very early on, we heard people comparing COVID-19 to the flu. And one of the big differences is how contagious it is. I mean, think about this. We've had over 40,000 people in this country die in 7 weeks. As opposed to, now I know in the flu, we have tens of thousands of people die each year, but not over a 7 week period.
Correct.
Mm. Question here from a listener. What facts or information have changed over the course of this emergency? You've touched on this a little bit. Has there been any different advice that you are giving now than you weren't giving in the beginning? Do you think that this will be a cyclical problem that we must deal with again?
Yeah, I think a lot of people are wondering, is this going to be a seasonal virus? A lot of coronaviruses are seasonal. So is this going to be something that returns in the winter? I think a lot of people are wondering, are we going to potentially see another surge in the fall, in the late fall, November, December type timeframe? And again, I think anyone who tries to say with authority that they know what will happen is being a little too confident, because I think right now we don't have enough facts to know what the seasonality of the COVID-19 virus will be. In terms of things that have changed and advice that has changed, absolutely. I mean, this has been, in hospital medicine, we see things changing all the time, guidelines and recommendations and which antibiotics are best for which disease, those sort of things change all the time. But this has been changing at a speed that I've personally never seen before. So, you know, we touched on it earlier about masks. You know, the whole mask policy has changed over time. I think what we're recommending in terms of treatment has changed. And, you know, now here at Penn State, initially we were doing supportive care like many places. Now here at Penn State, we're fortunate enough to be a part of a clinical trial to be able to test remdesivir, which is an antiviral. So that's something that's changed. Many changes in just a very short period of time over the last 7 weeks.
How are patients treated? There is no cure. So when someone is hospitalized, how are they treated?
Right. So one of the most important things for these patients, and it sounds very simple, is just pure oxygen. They need to get some oxygen supplementation. Because the virus causes a pneumonia, they need additional oxygen to be able to keep those levels up and perfuse their tissues. So we provide oxygen. We provide inhalers. We provide cough suppressants. We give Tylenol for fevers. As I mentioned, we do have several clinical trials going on here at Penn State. So remdesivir is an antiviral randomized clinical trial that started, I think, about a week and a half ago is when we started. We are also part of a trial that's being run out of the Mayo Clinic to offer convalescent plasma to patients who may be severely critically ill. So those are a couple of the treatments that we are trialing here to see if they make a difference.
I noticed you didn't mention ventilators. Is the use of ventilators, is that when a patient has become critical?
Yes. So it was interesting. I was talking to some of our medical students, and I didn't realize that this report was out there. But apparently one of the medical students told me there had been a report that ventilators don't help and we shouldn't be talking so much about ventilators. I think what we want to understand is that, of course, the ventilator doesn't cure the virus. What the ventilator does is allow us to help patients who are very severely critically ill with pneumonia from COVID-19 to still maintain oxygen levels in their blood. That's what we're using the ventilator for, to help oxygenation, not to cure the virus.
Do you use a medical student as a good source?
I was surprised. They said, we read this in the news. They said we shouldn't be talking about ventilators. And I said, oh.
Yeah, that I don't know. I might want to check his or her source on that one. David.
I don't know what news that was.
David in Gettysburg is on the phone. David, you're on the air.
Yes, I have a question. I hear comments about survival of virus on hard surfaces and disinfecting and so forth. But what about soft surfaces like one's clothing? If I come in from the outside, I've been outside, going to the grocery store, whatever, wearing clothes. And when I come home, do I need to disinfect those clothes, that is, change clothes and wash those, or what's the story with soft surfaces?
David, I think we would recommend to continue wearing clothes when you're out, as you mentioned, but thank you very much for your call. Dr. DeWaters, what about that, the soft surfaces? Because, you know, I was thinking of so many different scenarios, using your elbow or coughing in your elbow rather than into your hands, using your arm to open doors, that kind of thing. What about soft surfaces? And they are much more difficult to clean.
Absolutely. So it's been a little bit trickier to figure out how long can COVID live on clothing, you know, and I think that's a great question, and that's the reason why people are asking it. Hard surfaces has been pretty clear up to 9 days initially, and then they're saying, you know, if you disinfect, it dies very easily. Not clear how long it survives on clothing. No one really knows. And so what we are recommending is that if you have clearly dirty laundry, you might want to consider wearing gloves when you do that laundry. So for my patients that I sent home that are COVID-19 positive, anything that's wet or soiled, wear gloves when doing that laundry. The CDC also recommends doing laundry at the highest temperature the clothes can tolerate, so the highest heat of the water. In terms of, do you need to wash your clothes the second you come home? I don't think anybody has a clear-cut answer to that. I certainly do that myself, but I am working in the COVID units on a regular basis. So when I come home from the hospital, I certainly do wash my clothes immediately when I come home. But in terms of, if you're leaving your home to go to the grocery store, I don't think anybody knows if you have to come home and wash your clothes right away, because we just don't know how long it lasts.
How many COVID patients have you treated?
Oh, I am not even sure how many patients I have personally treated at this point. I believe we're 6 weeks into this, so I've probably cared for 20 to 30 patients at this point.
Do you, or are you concerned about your own safety?
I feel very safe because our COVID units are fantastic, and I absolutely love being able to take care of patients in those units because the nurses are fabulous. So we have good PPE. We have great protocols. We were very fortunate in Pennsylvania, is what I will say, in that we had extra time to prepare. And places like New York City didn't have time to prepare. They got kind of blindsided. And us having time to prepare made it much easier for us to build these type of units where you feel very safe being in them. So personally, I feel totally fine. I was in the COVID unit this morning admitting someone. So.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest today is Dr. Amy DeWaters, Associate Division Chief of Hospital Medicine at Penn State Health's Milton S. Hershey Medical Center. If you have a question or comment, 1-800-729-7532. You can send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Let's take a call from Tony in Lancaster. Tony, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks. It's all about me, actually. I'm calling about the testing. Maybe I should say as a background that my wife and I are both in our late 70s and have some chronic conditions. We're pretty active. But about the testing thing, since there is no, I don't see how you're going to get kids back to school unless you can test the kids. On the other hand, for an ordinary person sitting at home, if you start to feel sick with this thing, since there is no cure for it or treatment, basically, I would assume you wouldn't call your doctor and ask for testing. If you get sick enough, you'll go to the hospital in an ambulance, and then you'll be tested. But before that point, testing's really irrelevant, isn't it?
Thank you very much for your call. Dr. DeWaters, what about that?
Yeah, this is a great point because we hear this debate happening publicly as well. Really, this comes down to that population health epidemiologic perspective of we want to test you so that we know to put you in home isolation as quickly as possible. So you're not wrong when you say, if I get tested and I'm positive, essentially I'm going to manage my symptoms at home until I start to feel poorly and then I'm going to go to the hospital. You're 100% right about that. But what we do want to know is that we need to put you under home isolation so that you can protect the other people who may be coming into your home and so that we can limit you exiting your home so that we limit the transmission of the virus to other individuals. So that's really where it becomes important to want to know if you're positive. And that's why, as we talked about earlier, even patients who come in to get tested, they if the physician who sees them has high enough suspicion for COVID-19, that patient will be placed under home isolation before their test results even return.
And a point you just made seems to be an important one, that it's not just for your personal safety. It is for the people around you or that you may come in contact with, correct?
Absolutely, 100%.
A caller asked, we talked earlier about losing sense of taste and smell. When would this occur in the timeline of the illness?
Yeah, there were reports about this that were coming out that this was happening very early. Now, I would be cautious because I don't think that this has really been replicated in other settings, but this was coming out of some of the early reports from China and Italy, and they were describing it as sort of a prodrome type symptom. For instance, a symptom that develops before the virus really starts to show itself. But again, we haven't seen a lot of replication of that symptomatology here.
Yeah, I also saw a story over the weekend, and I shouldn't really be repeating stories that I don't know, whether it's been proven or not, a story about dogs being able to detect coronavirus with their sense of smell. Again, I'm not going to ask you to comment on that, doctor, but...
Well, I have three dogs, so...
Oh, there you go. Well, then you're set.
I'm set.
Anna asks, I have not heard or read anywhere that coronavirus lasts 9 days on hard surfaces, even the CDC site. Where does that info come from?
So initially, the 9 days was coming from an article that I believe was in the New England Journal of Medicine. And that was, again, where they were looking at rooms for patients. And I anticipate that all this data will change. I think that this is all going to be in flux as time goes on, because that's what I've seen personally. You know, initially we were seeing data that that you get symptoms only within 8 to 10 days, and then it was 3 days, and then it was 5 days. So I anticipate that all of that will change over time. But that was initially from an article, I believe, from the New England Journal of Medicine.
Mike is in Camp Hill. Mike, you're on the air.
Thanks. It's very informative.
Thank you.
Is it the case that if a person goes into, let's say, a food store one time, or they go in 10 times, or if they're exposed to someone with the virus for 5 minutes or 10 minutes one time compared to 10 times, is the person who is exposed 10 times more likely to get the virus?
Oh, yeah. So that's really tricky. No, not necessarily. Not necessarily. So repeat exposure, your risk certainly goes up, but not necessarily logarithmically like that. So I see someone 5 times and now I'm 5 times more likely to get the virus. Your risk may go up, but there's so many other factors at play that it would be difficult to say that your risk increases by 5 times. You know, for instance, if you see the person the first time and they actually have COVID-19 and they're coughing significantly, that's different than seeing them a second time and they're not coughing, and maybe you only see them for a brief amount of time. So it's really difficult to say how much risk changes with repeat exposure.
Mm-hmm. Anne asks, when will the antibody test be available locally, and will there be triage for someone to get it?
Yeah, the antibody test has caused a lot of questions to be raised. The antibody test is, I think, still a ways away from being clinically useful, and we still need to do a lot of work to make sure that those are accurate. So I would say the antibody test is still some time from being clinically useful for us. And I know they've been doing a lot of work on that in the UK. They've invested a significant amount of resources in trying to develop a really good antibody test, but it's just incredibly tricky because, first of all, as the World Health Organization mentioned over the weekend, you don't necessarily know that having antibodies grants immunity. And this circles back to what we were talking about with reinfection, and not really knowing what the reinfection rates are.
Noel asks, I have to travel across the country by car soon. I can camp and plan to do so, but still worry about the best way to travel safely. When I have to stop for the bathroom, should I try to find small towns, any gas station I pass and wash my hands really well? What should my focus be on?
Absolutely. If you have to travel across the country, I would say you want to make sure your focus is on washing your hands as frequently as possible, limiting the number of stops, and don't touch your face while you're in the car. And if you have to put on a bandana or something to help stop you from touching your face, try to do that. That would be my recommendation. And then I'm sure the Department of Health has more detailed recommendations than even that.
Dan asks, why don't we just concentrate on protecting those who are most vulnerable, the elderly and those with pre-existing conditions, by paying them to stay home and protect their jobs until safe for them to return, and do the same for anyone with a fever who feels ill? The mortality rate for all groups is about 5% and is far lower for those that are not elderly and do not have pre-existing conditions. I don't know if you could talk about policy about paying them to stay home, but what about just isolating those those who are most vulnerable?
Yeah, I think it's, again, this becomes tough because if you were to isolate just the elderly, for instance, the elderly still have to leave at some point to get food and for basic emergency needs, prescriptions. It's not that those are the most serious cases, but it's not that young people don't get infected. And this has been a really tough message to get across. You know, I would encourage everyone to go to the Pennsylvania Department of Health website. I look at it every day. But what might be shocking to people on that website is that the positive cases by age, the highest percentage is 25 to 49. So it's the 25 to 49-year-olds who have the highest percentage of positive cases. There's 39% of the cases in the state of Pennsylvania are in that age range. So you've got to realize those are the people that are carrying it around and potentially depositing it in the community. So when the elderly leave, they can still get exposed. So just exposing people who are high risk, it depends on what you mean by high risk. They are highest risk for getting hospitalized, and the elderly are highest risk for poor outcomes. But in terms of positive cases, they actually have a lower percentage than the 25 to 49 age demographic.
Judy called and says, I live in a retirement community and they deliver food to our homes. Do I need to wash the box the food comes in, the banana, before I peel it?
Yeah, so I would hope that your facility is taking reasonable precautions when they're preparing the food, and that might be something that you want to talk to your facility about, is making sure that the reasonable precautions are being taken in the kitchen. If precautions are being taken in the kitchen before the food's being delivered to you and people are wearing gloves, then you may not need to wash it.
Let's take a call from Michael in Dauphin. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning. Doctor, has anyone used a hyperbaric chamber to treat a COVID person, a patient that's in an extreme situation?
Thank you for your call, Michael.
Yeah, that is a fantastic question. I actually had a patient ask me that question 2 days ago. So, to my knowledge, we have not been using hyperbaric chambers in the U.S. for treatment of COVID-19. That being said, you know, take that with a grain of salt, because obviously I'm not aware of all of the treatments that have been trialed in the United States. But as of right now, we have not been using hyperbaric oxygen. We have been using ventilators, and we do use certain protocols with the ventilators to try to help with oxygenation. And that includes things like proning, meaning people laying on their stomachs while they're ventilated, tends to help with oxygenation. But to my knowledge, no use of hyperbaric oxygen chambers.
So lying on the stomach, why would that? The position of the lungs?
Yeah, it gets a little bit tricky in terms of the physiology, but as it turns out, that seems to help pretty significantly in certain respiratory diseases. It's something we've been doing for other respiratory diseases for a while, such as ARDS, acute respiratory distress syndrome. We use proning to help with the oxygenation levels in the blood while people are on a ventilator. So that has been used in COVID-19 as well.
Dr. DeWaters, we're out of time. I want to thank you very much. The hour just flew by. So many questions that we didn't get a chance to even answer. But in 30 seconds or less, advice that you could give to our audience?
I would say do everything you can to keep yourselves safe. Pennsylvania has the fourth highest number of cases in the country as of this morning, according to the CDC. So stay at home, wash your hands, stay safe. And we're here to care for you.
Dr. Amy DeWaters, Associate Division Chief of Hospital Medicine at Penn State Health's Milton S. Hershey Medical Center. Dr. Waters, thank you very much for your work and being for what you're doing at the hospital and for being with us today.
Absolutely. Have a great day.
Thank you. Coming up tomorrow, Lieutenant Governor Fetterman will be on our program.